This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio, and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. Each week, we talk with someone who is making a positive difference in applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens is that of Mana Forbes from the Waikato. He's got a background in education and IT. We're in the offices of Minded, a company that is intent on developing tools for young people to develop their capability and essential life skills.
Yes.
Welcome, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. And thank you for sharing this conversation.
Let's go right back, shall we? Where did you grow up?
Hi, okay. I grew up from Hamilton. I grew up in Raglan and near Kawhia as well, right by the beach. And I didn't realise what that really meant to me until I went away to Auckland High School. Because when we studied the seashore, I knew so much that I didn't know I knew about the seashore and the sustainability requirements of the seashore and the seashore life being shellfish, especially. So I was very blessed growing up in Raglan.
Do you still live in Raglan?
I have a place there, and we like to go back to Raglan and to live amongst our many relatives there. But I live in Hamilton, and it's been far easier to provide education for my young family to grow up, and also employment.
So, what did you want to be when you grew up?
You know, when I was a little boy, we were told we were going to do things and be like our fathers. It was highly likely we were going to have a job like my father. So I thought, oh, well, I love driving bulldozers. I love driving trucks. And I loved living on the land and being on a dairy farm and being on a sheep farm. I loved all that. But there were some things I enjoyed more, so I was actually quite confused. What I enjoyed was being in the city as well, and working in the city, in clean offices that I used to visit, and being in the hustle and bustle of a situation where you use a lot more of your mind and a lot more of your thinking, and it seemed even more exciting to me. Out on the farm, out in the country, it was lovely. But when you're sitting on the hill on the horse and you're trying to drive the cows or the sheep or trying to get your dog to do exactly what you wanted, as a young person, I became lonely. You can only have so much of a conversation with your dog or with the animals or with your horse. And you really needed to develop other parts of yourself. And even though you loved it, I needed company. And that's why I am not still living on the farm or way out in the country.
So where did you see your career going? You saw it going off a farm.
I did. but I didn't actually know how. But I had this image of replicating not my father, but one of my brothers who was being successful, living in the city and working for a large corporation. And I thought, that's the role model for me. And I started to head in that direction. Until I nearly made it, but I was attracted to do teacher training because there were a whole lot of education disciplines delivered within that environment, and so I did that because I needed some study disciplines and I needed to ensure that I completed. So graduation and completion was important to me back then, and which is why I didn't get into that corporate arena straight away.
Did you go teaching?
I did. I went teaching I taught for 3 years, and I was just at the beginning of my fourth year in the first term that I got shoulder tapped to join a corporation. And that at the time was a multinational. You may not remember, it was Burroughs Computers. It doesn't exist today under that label. And I had 9 fabulous years within the ranks of that company and had quite a bit of success. Learned a lot about computers, taught myself how to program in COBOL. Back then, I don't know if you're young and old enough to know COBOL or of COBOL, but it was exciting for me because it was a new world, and I was able to develop that part of me.
So what did they want a teacher from Raglan?
Yeah.
Who shoulder tapped you? What had they seen?
He was a manager of one of the Burroughs branches. He used to be in Auckland and then went to Napier, and then he went back to Auckland as his manager. But he's actually originally from Hamilton as well. And unbeknown to me, he went to high school, Hamilton Boys High, with my brother. They were in the same class, and I didn't know that. And what he saw was me be the best man at a wedding of a fellow who already worked for him. And he said, that's got to be the best man speech he's ever seen and heard. And he said, you have to come and work for me.
Because I'm getting married next week.
they were a bit like that. And I wasn't to find out until later he actually knew my brother, and he had an understanding of my background, and he thought I would suit. And it was interesting because that didn't, I had to go through all those aptitude tests and logic tests, and they came from the United States as part of this multinational company, which I built up a lot of confidence after I completed them, because I scored quite well. I had no idea that I had that aptitude. I had no idea whatsoever.
So what did they have you doing?
Sales. And also, back in those days, when you sold this computer, counting computer, you had to pretty much program yourself. And so you made a sale, you either got someone else's programs that they had already developed, or you customized and did, you did the major one for the company, and then you wheeled in a programmer who looked after them. It was a lot of fun. It was quite exciting, and it used to take up so much of your time that you had to balance your relationships and your marriage and so forth with the time taken to
work the longer hours, the long nights, completing a program, because you know you need it. The sale needed it. And I remember one time I actually had my wife come into the, and when I needed to finish this program, and I started working on the program, and I put a game up on the computer for her, which had never ever had a computer game back in those days, and she enjoyed it, and she had about a lovely 2 hours with me of enjoyment. So I thought, oh, that's a secret, I need to remember that one. But that was interesting experience, working, you know, and developing within that arena.
So that set you off on a career in IT?
In IT, yeah, and it was a, it actually helped me to further my knowledge and understanding actually in education, because of those experiences within IT. And also, IT was being introduced into education in a big way, and so I was able to participate in that arena as well, and participate with knowledge and confidence.
So you always managed to maintain that link back to education?
Yes, yes indeed, and I in fact helped a trust who became a private training establishment when that capability was made available by the Ministry of Education. And I was on their board for a period of time, and then I was able to procure at least 12 units of PCs for them to teach the rudimentaries of introduction to computing and word processing, and the initial spreadsheet developments that were going on at the time. And that was a significant step, because then in 1994 this institution was given a charter to become one of the first two wānanga within the realm of the ITPs, the Polytechs, back in 1994. And that was a huge step for education, and it actually opened the doorway for a lot of Māori people to participate in tertiary education. And I was so privileged to be part of that.
So you're on the council of the wānanga?
I was, yeah. And I spent many years being allowed to serve. And because of it, you were, you know, you say, why did you do that? There was so much social good that you were able to participate in. There was so much groundbreaking experiences that you were able to participate in, encourage and guide. There was some, you know, and if you ever want to say, you ask the question, were you making a difference? I believe we were. And I'm not talking about just me doing this. You know, I was part of a group of people. And I was privileged to be part of that group of people. And I believe we were making a difference. That doesn't mean to say that we haven't got a long way to go. You know, we've still got a lot, you know, there's still a lot to do in that arena. But from where we came.
So there's a lot to do, but you were making a difference. What difference needed making?
Accessibility. You know, there were a lot of people to whom tertiary education was a too high a mountain to climb to get access. And so we were able to provide entry-level programs to get them in the door and then start getting them within that tertiary framework of learning. And the other part was confidence building to encourage, you know, they talked today about, you know, retention, completion, graduation, it's been the really important aspects of tertiary education. You know, that achievement aspect is just so important. And we worked very hard in that arena. It was interesting that once our student, you know, we looked at it, what our student profile was, and actually we did have these second chance learners. But those second chance learners, some of them were aged in their 40s and 50s, having been made, say, redundant when their, you know, when the workplace that they had as their living closed down, and they had to then, you know, redirect their energies and re-educate themselves. And so we had an older age group than you know, possibly other institutions.
Is it fundamentally different? Is it the same but different? Different but the same? How do you describe what's the core?
Okay, it actually, if you lifted that whole Māori cultural ethos away, then you might say, oh, that's the same as, you know, that probably did down the road. And possibly it was. And especially today, because the politics down the road have changed as well, and they are actually more open and warm and welcoming than they used to be. So that's what it was like then. And so that was an important part of our development. And also we started looking for the thinking that we don't need to be the same as to how we were brought up on, you know, and educated. You know, how we take those fresh young minds and we, you know, and with that huge potential, huge opportunity, that we put them in a box.
So when you were involved in that essentially startup of a new way of education, were you allowed to pretty much start with a blank page and then say, right, let's sculpt it, and then say, look, we've got the quality at this level, accredited? Or were you sort of starting from a, here is an accreditable thing, now let's sculpt it to how we want it to be? How did you manage that?
There was an expectation that we would perform similar to other institutions. When we recognised that was a really, there were a whole lot of difficulties in doing that and replicating and yet having the same outcomes, you know, the percentages of completions and graduations. So we had to then, you know, re-engineer. We had to look at how we can change it so that our students would do what they were doing, and understand what it was they were doing, and we tried to then provide a link between their interests, their passion, and the link between the purpose. So the passion and the purpose became a significant part of what we were trying to achieve there. Because if we could harness the passion and have them recognise the purpose, it was a pleasure. You know, there wasn't drudgery and having to get, oh, I've got to go to, you know, class, I've got to go to study today. It was, hooray, it's Monday, you know.
I'm going back because I love being there, and I love doing this, and I love what I'm learning, and I love participating, and I love working with these people and the friends that I've made. You might say, oh, we're trying to create a wider family, and we were.
When we were developing sustainable practice at the Polytech,
yeah,
we didn't actually get much of it from inside the Polytech, but we did from outside the Polytech. Where's the effect of, I'm an accountant, this has got nothing to do with me. If we transform that, both the subject and the area, did you get much resistance? People saying, this is computing, Mara's got nothing to do with me. How can I possibly teach?
Yep.
Computing in a culpable Maori way. How did that work out?
Well, we were blessed to be able to train up Maori tutors, and that was the breakthrough, because that initial response was correct. This is computing, and this computing should be the same no matter who it is and where it is. That computer's going to operate the same, its operating system's the same, the program's going to be the same. What's not the same is the delivery of knowledge and the receiving of knowledge. So, in that two-way situation of communication in the classroom. And I come back to the interest, the passion, the purpose, and then the next one is the relationship, because it was the relationships that were developed in the classroom which actually created the passion that grew, and the love grew, the enjoyment grew, and the most unlikely people became the highly preferred tutors. And you wouldn't have picked it until you saw them in the classroom with that particular profile person.
Is it something about that being able to make the connection between the passion and the purpose? And I wonder if there's something in there about not just the narrative, but in terms of recognising what narrative's going to excite and engage people.
Yeah, and also when they started to see, because they arrived there and they'd been in this tunnel, and this was the first bit of light in the tunnel, and then they had to carry on, but what they saw was the light at the end of the tunnel, and they saw opportunity, and I think that was the real game. That was a big game. And some of them went on and to do teacher training, because computing had, everyone needed to have computing skills, many of the employment opportunities. And so they were able to compete for jobs because they had the skills.
Now, one of the things that you've done, because we're certainly not going to be able to cover all of the things you've been involved in, but one of the things that you've done is set up a high school.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Oh, that came from about from having young people not being able to engage in the number of the high schools locally. So they came to the Wānanga. So I had too many young people there, and I put them into, I had enough for two classrooms. So I called the Ministry of Education and said, I have these young people who are strongly not willing to engage back at their high schools. And they were, they were not old enough to do tertiary. So I thought, well, if we can replicate what we were doing in the tertiary sector into a high school, we might be successful. And it took quite a few years, but we finally were given the charter to go ahead to
to develop a high school. And surprise, surprise, what did we do? We created, you know, this, what we said was, what is it for? It's to give life to learning and purpose to life. And that was what we wanted to achieve. You know, so I come back to purpose. Purpose, and I found that, you know, when people saw purpose, they bought into, because they knew and understood. And if they agreed with the purpose, you actually had a strong supporter and a strong participant. And so I don't take credit for, you know, putting those words together, but I, you know, we were blessed to have a group of people who had, you know, different skills and capability. And you know, and if you have a person in your midst who can actually choose the word that suits what everyone's trying to develop and can help us identify what is suited. But we wanted to take that word called innovation, and we wanted to build on it, and we wanted to have people coming out the other, you know, out of our midst, ready for the next level. And we wanted to allow them to again say and identify their passion, identify their personal those parts of them. And we thought, how do we do that? How do we have people know and understand themselves? How do we allow them to understand their personalities and where their real strengths will lie? That's where we started to develop and work on, you know, that sort of psychometric assessment. Because if we could do that, then we could give them an individual tailored learning plan that is based on their psychometric assessment. And so that their learning can be, we keep the breadth of learning, but it all has purpose, because the individual knows the direction that they want to go. But I emphasise the fact that we needed to keep the breadth, because it's important that the individual can, in later part, you know, the latter part of their education cycle, start to narrow it down. But in the early days, it's really important that they maintain a wider level of opportunity within that arena.
And so right from the start of high school, they're looking ahead to what they're going to do next.
Yeah, and what we call that the exit strategy. So once you've had an understanding of your three major sectors of your brain, you know, upper, lower, middle, and whether you're left or right, you know, right, upper, right, lower, right, and right or left, middle. Once you had an understanding of that, then it was easier for you to make guided choices, because that's a guide, and we use it as a guide. But guided choices are way more than, you know, used to be a bit like tossing a coin, you know, and hoping. One part of that I would like to mention is that you might say, well, if you're in the upper, you know, if you're upper left brain thinker, you know, you'd be an accountant, or you'd be a person who likes to be precise with figures and data and so forth, or you'd be a doctor and you can, you know, and do medicine and become a researcher. But we're very quick to point out that the belief that I have is, doesn't matter how strong you are in the complete brain, and it doesn't matter where your dominance is, if you became a doctor, and you can become a doctor, what the area of medicine you will choose will actually then be more suited to your interests. So so that you can be a doctor, you can be a researcher, you know, you can be a specific aspect of medicine, you can live in the laboratory, or you could be a GP depending on your desire for engagement with people, or you could be in a third world country providing medical services because of your desire to engage within a sect of the world and a sect of the community who give you in return for your services a lot of love, a lot of thanks, and a lot of personal development.
In terms of the purpose not being just the purpose for, in terms of their personal career development,
yeah.
Do you do anything explicitly about exploring areas in which you care about? Like you say, you know, some people come out of this and go off to third world development or wherever. How do people... It's not intuitive that that should be an area you should go and work in.
Yeah. We decided that homework in a high school was not something that was looked upon as being a benefit to the individual. And so we decided we won't do homework. What we do instead is we said we will then say we're not going to do subject-based learning. And so we said, then what are we going to do? How do we change it? And we said, well, if university study or, you know, higher education is based upon problem solving or problem-based learning, we need to train our and have our young people start to learn that style of thinking and working, and we called it project-based learning. And the projects, in according to the year of study, they're guided through them, and within that, we will do tutorials to cover all their mathematics needs and language needs and science needs, and, you know, so we actually do and advertise tutorials, and we teach them to develop a sense of responsibility to attend the tutorial that they individually need to attend. So it doesn't matter which year they're in. If they're doing a level 2 course and they need to attend this particular tutorial, they go and attend it, and they might be with, you know, different aged students, but they all might be doing this particular level of that particular subject. So it's not a subject-based learning, it's project, and the completion of the project teaches them. So we're trying to develop their own personal independence and leadership and decision making. And we want them to, so that by the time they get through year 13, this has become part of their way of thinking, part of their way of working. And what's more important to us and to that individual is if their exit strategy says, I want to go to higher education, they are more likely to succeed in their first year of university or polytech, or, you know, wherever it is they are, Wānanga, because they've learned that whole level of independence, decision-making, and they know and understand the purpose why they're there and why they, you know, and the purpose for, and they understand the goals of why they're taking that particular course for that particular purpose. And for, you know, it's not like saying I did really well in maths and science and so forth, I want to go to university, I'm not sure what I want to be yet, and the poor individual is still sort of within that arena. So what I'm trying to get at here is we're trying to look at the whole of the person and help them and guide them through. And this actually includes, you know, includes their, you know, their whole physical side, includes their, you know, the sporting side, and includes their cultural side. It's you know, we're trying to have the complete person participate.
So those projects that they're designing themselves and mm-hmm. negotiating or whatever, given a free hand, do they do silly things? You know, are they the things that matter to them? But are they significant?
What
yes, do
they do? Yes, they. So they, you know, and they're given a whole number. And enterprise is part of quite a few of the projects. So that enterprise development, mm-hmm. you know, and you'll see them do projects that have enterprise orientation. They do projects that have environmental management orientation, community participation orientation. You know, the individual and looking at their dominant profiles of, you know, it's interesting to see the direction that they take. And it's the complete spectrum, and I just, you know, I continue to be amazed on how if a project might include two or three people, or three or four people, you know, and some of them may also make a short film to you know, as the outcome of the project. But within the project, it might be, say, environmental management of a piece of land, or, you know, or a stream. So there's all of that learning, the biology, the sciences, the, you know, all of that learning there. Then the other aspect is the technology learning and doing the film. And do, you know, so it's and they do tend to like the film, the filming, you know, because there's a whole lot of you know, wonderful technology. And there's a fellow who provides a drone, and so they have the camera up there, and they, you know, it's all a lot of fun. But, you know, it generates so much, you know, that they put so much energy and passion to, because of some of the enjoyment.
I just stopped myself from saying, and this is successful. There are kids that go on to med school from this.
Yes,
but. But I realised, as I was about to say that, that that's me presupposing what success looks like.
Yeah.
How does the school define success? How does the community define success? How do the kids define success? Do those three things match up? What's the...
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. Because there are different views on what success is. You know, and we celebrate success if someone gets an apprenticeship. You know, that is a success, a real success, because they're not easy to come by, apprenticeships, and no matter what. So someone might get a hairdressing apprenticeship, someone might get a building construction, someone might, you know, no matter what they are, apprenticeships are really important. So what we tend to celebrate success as being the fulfillment of your exit strategy. So it's what you decide, you know, you're going to be working to. If you've reached a fulfillment of that, that is success, no matter what it is. Because if you've agreed on your exit strategy with both the parents and the school, then it's a really important thing. There's another level of measurement too that we struggle with, and that is the measurement by the funder, being government, who say, we want you to perform at this level of NCEA successes in level 1 and level 2 and level 3 and so forth. So we do that because we're obliged to do that. But that is not the driver. The driver remains, for the school, remains with the students. The driver of the success of the student. being the fulfillment of their exit strategy. And so we you know, and the other part we really like to do is have them, you know, in the life skills and the capability, we try and have that developed too, so they have a good grasp of communication. For me, that's a major. And along the way, they have an understanding of working in relationships. And relationships are, you know, group working, working as a team, being in a team, being together, being in, you know, on how they can know, communicate, and support. And it's two-way communication, two-way levels of support, all through, you know, multi levels, and so it's that's another aspect of success for them as well.
So as I said, we're sitting in the offices of Minded.
Yes.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but Minded is trying to take these ideas and spread them wider.
Yes. Yeah, we're trying to. There's a word I've since learned in the last 9 months of doing what we've been trying to do, and it's called democratizing. You know, we're trying to democratize all these things, or if you're in the education system, normalize could be another way of putting it. I'm not sure. And that's what Minded is trying to do, because this is outside of that subject learning, and it's and these things aren't, you know, they haven't been put on, you know, they haven't been written for tertiary institutions. They've been written more for people, individuals, learners. So we're talking about, in Minded, we target from, you know, year 7 and 8, which is, you know, 10, 11, 12, that area, right through to corporate. So we've worked with professionals, you know, lawyers, corporate groups, large companies, and even a very successful band, you know, music group, who took their name from their time as students in Dunedin of all places. I think 660 was the number of the house in their street, and we work very closely with them, and we give them guidance, goal setting. And
so is it the same thing? It's about identifying that exit strategy, using some tools to work out what that might be.
Yep, it's the same thing, but it's just at different levels. So what we do with children, we do with adults, and we reposition it so it suits an adult. Yeah.
And what success for that going to look like? For Minded, not for the end of, not for the
for Minded. For Minded, it will, if we can get it out there to every school and high school and so forth, and then because of, you know, and because we've been able to do it with scale, if we can do it with scale, then we will succeed in making it accessible to everyone.
You gave a conference talk a few years ago that I really enjoyed. Yeah. And you focused it around navigation. I think it was one of your sons,
yes,
on a,
yes,
yes, ocean-going walker. And it struck me about the... What struck me about that was that you use one story to tell another story.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if that's part of what we're talking about here, is that it's this, you know, identifying that there's a whole lot of different ways of measuring success, of working out what journeys are. I'm not sure where I'm going with that question, but it struck me.
I've had a thought while you were saying that. On the walker, when you're navigating with your mind and your knowledge of the stars, your knowledge of the ocean currents, your knowledge of the wind, you know, and your knowledge of the birds, your knowledge that some birds at this particular time are flying in a different direction, your knowledge, where, you know, the Southern Cross gives you that guidance, or if you are, you know, you might see the Northern Star, you might see the Pleiades, you might see, you know, the various stars. And I was to learn that in your mind, you don't actually sail to that destination. In your mind, you bring the destination to you. So it's a different way of thinking. Having then learned that, it helps you realize that there are many, many other ways of thinking to find and reach the success. So if you bring the destination to you, the success is when that destination arrives to where you are. You know? So if you have an exit strategy, and there's a desk, you know, now university is not a destination. You know, higher learning is not a destination. It's on the course, it's on the pathway, and you navigate through that. And your navigation will bring your destination to you through that pathway.
Some questions to end with. We haven't really talked about, do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
When I think of sustainability, I think of it being affordable and also being able to stand in its own right and continue to stand. So it will be here, there, standing this time next year and the following year and the following year and the following year, and we haven't used it all up because it's been able to replenish no matter what it is.
Does it require different ways of thinking to get us there?
I believe so. And I believe that sustainability is the long game. It has to be the long game. You know, short game is not sustainable.
Did I see an article with your name on it or associated with it? Members of your family built a combined house or something?
That was relatives.
Right.
Yeah, and they did a really good job on that. That was, what they were doing was participating in sustainability. Yeah, what you might have seen me do is build some houses with my relatives for the sustainability of our culture by having people populate near our marae. We needed to populate the marae, so we needed to make that marae sustainable. So we built these houses to bring them back to live there.
So yeah, you know, I think when I hear those sorts of things, it really does pull that notion of sustainability being, you know, everything is a very holistic view.
Yes.
That you're trying to fix the environment, or you need to fix, you know, find a few places for people to live, yeah, and so on and so on. Yeah. But it's a different way of thinking.
Yeah, and so what we were doing, we were bringing, you know, the goal and the success was over there, so we brought them to us. You know, that comes back about bringing the island to you. We brought the people to us.
What do you think are the cries that we should be following to find a sustainable future?
I think the cries are coming from those young people who we actually leave by the wayside, who are still locked into a education system of the paradigm of one. You know, one classroom, one teacher, one subject, 1 hour, one day, 1 week, and each hour or period, as they're called during the day, operates as a silo. And the connection isn't there. And it's hard for the learner, that particular type of learner, to see the purpose. And in that paradigm of one, without that connection, without the relationship, it doesn't engage, and it doesn't maintain that engagement. And we're losing too many young people. A along the way.
What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
I think the development of this, you know, courseware that we're doing in mind. Now, this may seem like an advertisement, and that's not what I'm really trying to say. But what I am saying is I think the direction of what we're taking is so important to today's learning, and so important in preparing people for living and for communication and working together in relationships, which are the important needs and requirements for both survival and sustainability of the individual, of the family, of the wider family. And if we can get this courseware into learning institutions, and if they can blend it into their delivery of what it is they and how it is they deliver, then I believe we will be able to bring in, you know, we will be able to cast our net and bring in more young people to into that learning space, but probably more into that space of success, because I think it's success. If we can give them confidence in knowing themselves, everybody enjoys finding out more about themselves.
We're writing a book of these conversations. We're calling it Tomorrow's Heroes. How do you describe your superpower? What is it that you're bringing to this positive future?
All right. I'll describe it to you pretty simply. You may remember when you were young in school and you used to put all these dots and then do these squares, you know, put your name in. Well, my superpower is connecting dots. If ever I could do something, it's connect some dots. And I do like to have other people with other superpowers to work with. But if you said to me the question that you just asked, I can connect dots, and I enjoy connecting dots, and the dots that I connect have been very, very helpful, successful, and we continue because of that. That's the gift that I have, connect the dots.
Okay, four more quick questions. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
In a couple of areas, yes. You know, because in the areas that I have passion, I will embarrass myself and people around me. I will, you know, thump the table. I will, you know, I will want to. I don't want people walking out the door not thinking that I was serious about this particular purpose.
What challenges are you looking forward to in the next couple of years?
Probably just continuing on this pathway, and the challenges of trying to get the establishment and trying to work within the government structures of thinking, because that therein lies, you know, the greatest challenge. And if we can find a crack or two there, and, you know, and work our way through that narrow space.
So if you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would it be?
For either the Ministry of Education saying we recognise this, we see the value of this, and we need to have it in all of our high schools, middle schools.
Do they need to, like, high schools can pick this up, they don't need to, like, throw away. You said your high school doesn't have subjects.
Yeah, that's right.
But a normal high school can adopt this kind of direction.
Absolutely.
Within the subject framework.
Absolutely, easily. But when I say easily, they can do it, and they don't need to make any major, they don't need an act of parliament. They can actually make it through their board of trustees. But people will only do what they know, and they will only do what they understand and where they see the achievement. But if they were given a greater level of guidance to where that achievement lies, then
because we look at places like Finland and say, you know, they're doing something right, but it's really encouraging to know that something right's going on here as well.
Yes, and yeah, well, it's true. There are some nice people and people worth listening to.
So lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
I say that the wonderful thing we have today is a computer, we have these search engines and so forth, and to seek out, listen to the many podcasts that have been made, and try to gain an understanding, and also, if you can make a difference, work out what that might mean to you. Work out what that might mean to your family, your wider family, and your sphere of influence and relationships, because making a difference is probably the most wonderful and profound thing that you can do in your life.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.